From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Peter Melman, the creator of the new ABC sitcom called It's Like, You Know. The series satirizes life in Los Angeles. Before creating the series, Melman was a writer and co-executive producer of Seinfeld, where he originated such expressions as sponge-worthy and yada, yada, yada. Most episodes of Seinfeld had scenes set in a New York coffee shop. We'll talk to the owners of a popular Brooklyn restaurant called Junior's that's famous for its cheesecake, shrimp salad, and its bright orange booths. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Peter Melman, is the former Seinfeld writer and co-executive producer who gave us such expressions as yada, yada, yada and sponge-worthy. He left Seinfeld in 1997 to launch his own sitcom. That series, called It's Like You Know, airs its third episode tonight on ABC. The show satirizes life in Los Angeles. The main character, Arthur, played by Chris Eigmann, is a magazine writer from New York City who comes to L.A. to write a book about why he hates Los Angeles and all the self-absorbed, narcissistic people who live there. One of those self-absorbed people is the guy he's staying with, his old college roommate, Robbie, played by Stephen Eckhold. Robbie has made a fortune in L.A., telecasting the Jewish High Holy Days on pay-per-view cable. He calls it pay-per-Jew. In this scene from last week's episode, Arthur, the New Yorker, walks in on Robbie and is surprised to find him tweezing his eyebrows.
You put a lot of work into yourself, don't you?
That's a labor of self-love.
Did your eyebrows ever get out of control? I don't know. Being me doesn't really require my full attention. What are you doing today?
This isn't enough. Actually, I'm working on a new idea.
Oh, another money-making scheme?
What do you think of this? The Wits End Catalog.
The Wits End Catalog?
Yeah, yeah. It's a catalog for people who are just sick and tired of everything. Huh. Don't you think America would love it?
Don't ask me anything about America. I don't know anything about it. I'm from New York.
I think it could be as big a moneymaker as pay-per-Jew.
How much more money do you need?
You can't put a monetary value on money.
Peter Melman, welcome to Fresh Air. Go ahead, say it.
Great to be here, Terry.
There you go. Now, how did you hit on the idea of the New York writer coming to Los Angeles and dealing with Los Angeles as the theme for your series?
The main thought was to have a city be an actual character in a show, if not the star of the show. And in It's Like You Know, Los Angeles is the star of the show. And it's all about how that city impacts on these five characters. So actually there are six characters, five humans and one city. And I could not do a show about New York because I had just been at Seinfeld. And I was trying to do anything to differentiate myself from my previous experience, which is impossible, but I tried. So I took on Los Angeles, where I happen to live. And it's a place I like, but it's also a place that's so ripe for humor. So, you know, and I needed one character to pretty much be my mouthpiece, which is the Arthur character, who's played by Chris Eigmann. And it's wonderful to have an actor like that to be my mouthpiece, because he speaks so much better than I do.
Well, you were writing the lines for him, though.
Yes, I am writing the lines for him. But but he utters them so beautifully.
Now, this character, Arthur, comes to Los Angeles to write a book called Los Angeles, How Can You Stomach It? And it's supposed to be a book about why he hates Los Angeles. And although this trip is the first time he's ever been there.
Right.
What was your project that brought you to Los Angeles from New York?
I came out here for a change of life. It was not any specific project. I was a freelance magazine writer, just like Arthur. I was writing for GQ a lot, some for the New York Times Magazine, and all the women's magazines. And I just felt a little stagnant, and I'd been to L.A. many times, and I just thought it would be nice to have a little bit of a change. I originally came out thinking it might just be for the summer, but in the back of my mind, I thought, who knows how long this could last.
What kind of magazine articles had you been writing?
I wrote a lot of things that were actually very good training for Seinfeld. I wrote articles about, dating the vegetarian. I wrote a diet called the We Just Broke Up Last Night Diet, which is what you eat for the 5 days after you've been dumped.
Which is what?
It's basically, coffee and cigarettes, until you meet somebody else and then, boom, steak dinners. And I actually got, hired. I might be jumping ahead here, but I actually got hired at Seinfeld on the basis of an article that I wrote in the New York Times, which was an About Men column I had written in the New York Times Magazine about a day I had spent after a breakup with a girlfriend. I spent the entire day walking through Manhattan trying to spot a celebrity, and I wouldn't go home till I did.
What? Was this supposed to help you over the breakup?
No, I think it was just that I wasn't too well grounded in planning solo weekends anymore. So I have such hyper-evolved eyes for spotting celebrities in the street that I walked out my door one Saturday morning, and I thought I saw Tom Jarrell of ABC News, which to me is a very easy spot. I mean, I have spotted, you know, Grace Paley in New York. We're talking, you know, obscure spots. So when I got closer, it turned out it wasn't Tom Jarrell, and I was so kind of insulted that I decided, okay, that's it. I'm going to spend the entire day until I spot a celebrity. So I walked all over Manhattan, and I recounted that story in the New York Times, and ultimately that was the writing sample that Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David read.
Had you submitted it, or did they just see that and call you up?
No, I had bumped into Larry David out here. I had met him two or three times in New York. I bumped into him out here, and he said, and forgive me, whenever I quote Larry David, I have to actually do his voice. He said to me, you know, I'm doing this little TV show with Jerry Seinfeld, so, you know, maybe you could give me a writing sample. And I had never written dialogue before other than, you know, making up quotes. And so I basically gave them this About Men column, and Jerry loved it. It was a fairly funny, somewhat bittersweet piece, and Jerry loved it, and I got a shot to write one script on the show, which turned out to be the first freelance script that Seinfeld had ever produced.
What was the script?
It was called The Apartment. It was where Jerry got Elaine an apartment in his building without thinking, and then realized, oh my God, I've just gotten my ex-girlfriend an apartment in my building. You know, and he just realized how much it would cramp his style. And, you know, I had this really good run in there where Jerry said to George, you know, George says, how could you do that? And Jerry goes, because I'm an idiot. And then Jerry says, you know, you may think you're an idiot, but I'm a much bigger idiot than you. And throughout the entire show, George and Jerry are arguing about who's a bigger idiot between them, each arguing for themselves. And also in that episode, there was a party for the New York Marathon, and George decides to try a sociological experiment of wearing a wedding ring to the party just to see if women would be coming onto him left and right, which they were.
You're right, because he thinks that married men are more attractive
oh, yeah.
to women. So all these things in the first episode, were they based on things that you had experienced or had friends who had experienced?
No.
Wait, you never tried the wedding ring come on?
No, I never have. I don't know. You know, it's funny. When I went in to pitch the ideas with Larry and Jerry, we came up with that as the idea, and I went off to write it. In most shows, they would give you moment for moment of what you're supposed to write, and basically it becomes a question of just connecting the dots. But once we had one good idea of Elaine moving into Jerry's building, Larry said, okay, go ahead and write it. You know, it was completely, you were left off on your own. So the whole thing about trying on the wedding ring, I just wrote as I was going along. They didn't even know I was going to put that idea into the show. And I looked back at that quite a bit over my years at Seinfeld, thinking about how freely I wrote on that first one, because, you know, the more and more knowledge you got over the years while you were writing, you know, the more difficult it was in certain ways. And you knew more, but you weren't writing as freely.
No, when you first started writing for Seinfeld, did you have the voices of Jerry and George and Kramer and Elaine in your head? Or did you need help in writing in their style of speaking?
I think that's the one advantage I had. I had absolutely no problem adapting to the voices of the characters. And I think that owes a lot to the variety of magazines I wrote for, because I had a pretty strong writing voice, but I would change that voice if I were writing for Mademoiselle magazine as opposed to GQ, as opposed to the New York Times. So I was always adjusting my own voice. So I was very good at at picking up the voices of things and just adapting it to my writing style. So I had absolutely no trouble picking up the voices of those four characters.
My guest is Peter Millman, the creator and executive producer of the new ABC sitcom, It's Like You Know. He used to work on Seinfeld as a writer and co-executive producer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Millman. He's the creator and producer of the new ABC series, It's Like You Know, which is set in Los Angeles. He was a writer and co-executive producer of Seinfeld. Now, you've said that when you were writing for Seinfeld, that being around Jerry Seinfeld and the co-founder of the series and one of the major writers, Larry David, being around them forced you to be aware of the smallest things that go through your mind and to try to kind of grab some of those things and expand them into an episode, you know, expand them into a storyline. Right. And that often those things were embarrassing things. And you've said the more embarrassing, the better. So
yes.
What's a good embarrassing thing that has happened to you that you've been able to make into a storyline?
Well, I was once supporting somebody in the AIDS walk, and I was writing my name down, and this was at my health club, and I happened to look up the list of other people who were supporting this person in the AIDS walk, and I saw the phone number of a girl who I kind of had some interest in, and I tried to call, and she had an unlisted number. I got her number right off an AIDS walk list, and I was thinking, this is the most horrible, the lowest thing I can do, and boy, what a great Seinfeld episode.
Now, how did you, I don't remember that, how did you use it?
That was in an episode called The Sponge.
Oh.
And, you know, Jerry gets this woman's name off an AIDS walk list, and Kramer ends up doing the AIDS walk. And we thought it would be very funny if Kramer refused to wear the AIDS ribbon on the walk, and he got beaten up by a couple of gay thugs who we had used on the show earlier. They had turned up in the Soup Nazi episode, and, you know, they were apparently thugs with a conscience, because they did the AIDS walk. So that idea came out of an incredibly embarrassing moment.
Did you write the sponge part of the episode, too?
Yes, the whole thing.
Describe the sponge part and where that came from.
Well, I was actually driving home listening to National Public Radio, All Things Considered, and I heard that the sponge went off the air.
The contraceptive sponge.
The contraceptive sponge.
Went off the market.
Went off the market, and I immediately thought to myself, what if Elaine is a sponge user and she has to hoard these sponges? She buys out the entire West Side because she loves this product so much. And then we came up with the idea of that she's got a limited number of sponges now, so it changes her entire screening process for who she sleeps with. A guy has to be particularly sponge-worthy for her to sleep with her now. So that was, I'd say that was one of the most gratifying ideas I ever got, because it's kind of dropped out of the sky. I do not listen to music on my way, in my car ever since then, because I'm just hoping to come up with some idea.
Did the word sponge-worthy make it into any dictionaries?
No, I don't think so. Yada yada kind of got a run on that.
Did you write yada yada?
Yes.
Yada yada is in the dictionary now, I think, at least in one of them. Tell us about how you originated yada yada.
Yada yada was a very interesting thing, because we had this other idea for George dating a girl who had one little small tick in her personality. Nothing very annoying, but then George would meet her mother, and her mother would have this tick or quirk times 10. So George would meet this girl's mother and get a look at what the future would be. So then the big problem was trying to come up with what that tick or quirk was. And I heard somebody say yada yada, and I thought that was so funny, and I wanted to use that as the tick. But then I realized that if the girl were to say, if we establish this girl as someone who says yada yada a lot, and then she says, Boy, so last night my ex-boyfriend came over really late and yada, 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 I'm really tired today. I dropped off the whole, after that, I just dropped off the whole story about the mother because that seemed like a funny enough story in itself. And the interesting thing is that I had no idea that this yada, yada thing would take off like it did. In fact, I was slightly disappointed by that because in that same episode, we had Jerry being accused of being an anti-dentite. Because his dentist, who had converted to Judaism purely so he could, you know, be politically correct in making Jewish jokes, you know, and then Jerry makes one dentist joke and he's accused by Kramer of being a rabid anti-dentite.
That was very
and,
funny.
I loved the anti-dentite thing, and I was hoping that was what would catch on, but yada yada basically caught on because it makes for very easy headlines in newspapers about Seinfeld. You know, you could use one yada, two yadas, three yadas, and it fills up your headline space. So yada yada just went through the roof. Ad nauseum, I would have to say.
What was one of the jokes that you wrote for the dentist?
We kind of wrote that joke as, actually Jerry, I think, came up with that joke where... Jerry, there was a scene which I absolutely loved. This was actually the benchmark of the show. I wanted to get Jerry into a confessional booth because he shares the same dentist as this priest. And he's, you know, saying to the priest that, you know, I have to say, I think Dr. Whatley converted to Judaism purely for the jokes. And the priest says, and this offends you as a Jew? And Jerry goes, no, it offends me as a comedian. And then the priest says he'll talk to Dr. Whatley because he's getting some wisdom teeth removed. And Jerry says, oh, good luck. You know what the difference is between a sadist and a dentist? Newer magazines. So that's how the that joke started getting around. And Kramer heard about it. And, of course, Kramer, you never know what side of an issue he was going to fall on. So... he accused Jerry of being a rabid anti-dentite.
That was a great episode. I think you wrote the episode in which Jerry and Elaine come up with the rules that they can use to guide them. So if they sleep together, they'll be able to maintain their friendship. So this is their rules
No.
You didn't write that one?
Oh, no. Uh-uh. I could only wish I wrote that one.
Okay.
Larry David wrote that one. And for me personally, that's my favorite episode in the history of the show. I thought... that first scene when they make the rules for how they could sleep together and still remain friends, I honestly thought that was the peak of television ever. I thought that scene was as beautifully written as any ever. And also teamed up with the companion scene of, you know, George getting it out of Jerry, you know, about this whole relationship. But because it speaks to such a basic desire in life, you know, to actually, you know, have all the pleasure of a relationship without any of the responsibility. It's the classic having your cake and eat it. And, you know, it's never, the word sex is never used in there. It's always referred to as that, and they point to the bedroom. And then they talk about the friendship being this, and they kind of point to each other, you know. So it's always that. All we have to do is take this, being the friendship, and add that. And they point to the bedroom, and they come up with these rules. You know, that's a great thing about Seinfeld, trying to always thinking that these people are going to you know, beat the odds on something that people have been trying to do unsuccessfully for 5,000 years.
Peter Melman is my guest, and he was a writer and co-executive producer for Seinfeld. Now he's the creator and producer of the new ABC sitcom, It's Like You Know, which is set in Los Angeles. What are some of the things that you have to think about now as the creator and producer of a new series that you didn't have to worry about after joining Seinfeld?
Instead of just thinking of individual episodes and ideas for episodes individually, I have to be very aware of the arc of the entire season. You know, I have to just be aware of, does episode 6 seem too much like episode 5? And there's a tremendous amount of responsibility for the overall content of the show now, which I didn't have at Seinfeld. I could concentrate on just writing funny episodes, just coming up with really good ideas. And, you know, on top of that, you know, I always feel that everything in sitcoms is basically working against you. I've spent all my professional life pretty much sitting alone and writing. Now I'm a boss all of a sudden. I have to deal with 100 people all the time. People are constantly coming into me talking about the wardrobe, the sets, and I have to deal with that now. It's being an executive producer of a TV show is very contrary to your entire life as a writer.
When you were interviewing at different networks for the placement of your new series, It's Like You Know, what did you think the common wisdom was at the TV networks about what makes a successful sitcom?
I think the common wisdom of what makes a successful sitcom is a whole group of things that I thought as a Seinfeld writer we had completely dismissed. You know, that the characters have to be likable, that in the pilot you have to get to know the characters. You know, I thought Seinfeld had gotten rid of that. I thought we had established that if these people are funny, that's all that really matters. But it's not that way. I'm sad to say that I think the networks are constantly underestimating the intelligence of the audience. And the audience is so intelligent out there, and they're so up on everything. I think you have to strive to talk over their heads if you can do it. And that's not easy. You know, and they're tough. I think the audience kind of assumes you're full of it until you prove otherwise.
Peter Millman is the creator of the new series It's Like You Know, which airs Wednesday nights on ABC. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from Bantam Books, publishers of Robert Thurman's book, Circling the Sacred Mountain, A Spiritual Adventure Through the Himalayas, written with Tad Wise. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our talk with Peter Millman about writing for Seinfeld and his new sitcom, It's Like You Know. Then we talk with the owners of Junior's, a restaurant that's become a Brooklyn institution. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Peter Millman, the creator and executive producer of the new ABC sitcom, It's Like You Know. It's about a New York writer who comes to L.A. to write a book about why he hates Los Angeles. Millman learned about sitcoms from his years as a writer and co-executive producer for the series Seinfeld. When you started your own series, It's Like You Know, did you have to get rid of the voices of Jerry and George and Elaine and Kramer? You were so used to writing for them.
That was a bit of a problem. And it was very interesting that sometimes I would still be writing in their voices and I would have this other group of actors now and they would say the lines and it would sound completely different than I heard it in my head. It was very strange. It was a tough transition. you know, I've been pretty much consumed with Seinfeld for 7 years. And like I had said before, you know, going on to a new show after writing for Seinfeld was, you know, like starting to date again after your first wife has died.
Oh, jeez.
But, you know, you learn to love again.
Now, you've said that many of the best Seinfeld plot lines came from things that actually happened to the writers. So I want to ask you about some of the plot lines in your new series and see if any of this happened to you. Did you, when you moved to L.A., live in the home of an incredibly wealthy friend?
No, I did not. I lived in the home of a friend who was wealthier than me, but it wasn't a guest house, and I just lived in his den for about 2 months. But no.
Did you have a well-known actress living next door?
No.
Okay,
but,
so
you know, that's a these are big, you know, but having an actress living next door is a big part of life in Los Angeles.
Everybody has an actress living next door, don't they?
Celebrities just impose themselves on your life constantly out here. I remember driving back from Malibu one day and on the radio hearing that Yitzhak Rabin had been shot and killed. I was at a red light and I was sitting there and I was shaking my head. And I happened to look up into the next car pulled up next to me, and there was Dustin Hoffman shaking his head. And I was just thinking, boy, this city, it's just constantly surreal with celebrities. And that is basically where I got the idea of having this celebrity living next door.
Now, the celebrity next door is played by Jennifer Grey, and she basically plays a version of herself. Her name is even Jennifer Grey on the show. And on the show, as in real life, people don't recognize her because she's had nose jobs. And that really irritates her, you know, that people don't recognize her anymore, and they don't even believe it's her. How did you get Jennifer Grey to play Jennifer Grey? How did you even think of the idea?
Well, as I said, the first idea was just to have a celebrity playing herself. And, you know, I always liked Philip Roth a lot, and I love the way he blurs the line of reality. And that's part of what established that character. And I had spoken to a couple of other actresses about it. I had Terry Hatcher in mind because I had written an episode with her on Seinfeld. You know, maybe Jennifer Beals, I had met with her. But I always had Jennifer Grey in the back of my mind because we were somewhat friendly, you know, very friendly, actually. And, you know, she's got kind of a juicy background, but, you know, the juicier the background, the more delicate it would be to want to play that character. And so I took an incredibly cowardly way out as far as presenting the idea to her. I was talking to her on the phone, and I just kind of told her I was writing this pilot, and I started going down the characters, and I said, oh, we have this guy moving out from New York, and then there's this young girl who's a process server and a masseuse, and then there's this one guy who's a trustafarian, and there's this one guy who made all his money by bringing the Jewish holidays home on pay-per-view, and, you know, and I gave her the paper Jew line, and she was laughing, and I said, you know, and then there's this other character who's an actress who's actually playing herself. She's a real person. Yeah, so I took a real cowardly way of presenting it to her. I was kind of like half offering it to her without even offering it to her at all.
And she bit.
And she bit. Thank God.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Melman. He's a former writer and co-executive producer of Seinfeld, and he's the creator and producer of the new sitcom set in Los Angeles called It's Like You Know. You know, Seinfeld used to be called a show about nothing, blah, blah. And it kind of in its own way went from being a show about, like, little absurd or embarrassing moments in life to being about a show, to being a show about much more improbable experiences.
Yes, I would agree with that.
How did that transition happen from a pretty reality-based sense of absurdity to a very improbable sense of action?
You know, I think when you've done when you're verging on 180 episodes, you can't get less creative. You have to get more. There are just, you know, there are a lot of those small stories out there, but they become harder and harder to find. You know, you're in your sixth season of Seinfeld, you come up with an idea and everybody's going, well, we kind of did that in season two. And you go, oh, right. You know, so it got a little bit more difficult to find really small stories. So, And the fact is, we had virtually an unlimited budget to do these shows after a while. So, you know, we experimented with doing some movies and, you know, mini movies. But even in the earlier years, we would occasionally do that. You know, like the Bubble Boy episode was in the midst of probably the greatest Seinfeld season ever. And that was a big road trip. And, you know, the next season was the Hamptons episode, which was more like a French farce, but, you know, also very wide-ranging. So it did get harder and harder to just do shows about very small things. And, you know, I regret that, but I think that it's absolutely inevitable and there was no way around it. I love the small shows. In fact, I always found it very gratifying that I did the Yada Yada in my final season with the show, because that was pretty much of a small show, you know, based on very small things.
When you started It's Like You Know, did you have a sense of where in that scale from small things, a show about nothing, to big, improbable, impossible things you wanted your show to fall?
I naturally gravitate towards the smaller stories. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's an episode that we did that is probably smaller than anything Seinfeld ever did. It's an episode called The Conversation, and 70% of it is the Robbie character and the Arthur character, the two old friends, just talking about relationships and marriage for 70% of the show. And there's no story in there at all. There, you know, the conversation takes place at the guest house and in cars and in a restaurant and back to the house. There's absolutely no story in there. And it was all of these things that I had thought about relationships and marriage over the years, and I kind of combined them into one show, and I got more pleasure out of that one than anything I've ever written for television. And it's, you know, that's much smaller than anything Seinfeld ever did. But, you know, I couldn't really do that on Seinfeld because that was not my show. It was Larry David's show. And I was constantly adapting to his sensibility. But this particular episode is purely my sensibility, and it was really gratifying.
I'm wondering if writing for Seinfeld and writing your new series, It's Like You Know, has changed your idea of what embarrassing means. You know, I think we've established that some of the things that have happened to you or that you've done that were kind of embarrassing have really turned into to terrific storylines. Do you feel like that gives you more liberty to do things that you should be ashamed of, or does it at least help to take the edge off of embarrassment when you inadvertently do something stupid?
Yes, it takes the edge off embarrassing things, although not so much. I mean, I occasionally will do something and just feel so embarrassed about it and dwell on it for days. But, you know, it certainly does help when you can make it into an idea. But, you know, it's interesting. Larry David used to invite problems. It was his idea. He was at a restaurant one night, and the tables were very close to one another, and there was a couple at the next table, and the wife sneezed, and the husband didn't say, God bless you. And Larry said, God bless you. And then she looks up at him and goes, and he says, well, I wouldn't have said anything, but I could tell he wasn't going to open his mouth. And, I mean, you know, just inviting things like that. And that was my first year at Seinfeld. I was just amazed that he would do things like that. And, you know, I tried to follow suit. I've never been quite successful at it. As you know, Larry is utterly unabashed about these things. And I'm kind of happy to say that I am still somewhat abashed by these things because, you know, when you spend your entire life trying to come up with Seinfeld episodes, it could swallow you whole. You know, you could stop living an existential life. You could get to the point where you're just looking at your life, looking at your thoughts, and it's basically not living because you're just observing yourself and your life, but you're not really living it anymore.
Did you come close to that?
I came very close to that.
When did you realize you were coming close to that?
I just remember one night being at dinner with a group of people who had come in from out of town, from old friends from New York. And I just didn't think that I was one of the funny people at the table anymore. I felt that I was just so much watching the conversation and watching my participation in the conversation that I wasn't funny anymore. I wasn't an amusing person to have sitting around the table. And that's when I tried to figure out a way of backing off a little.
And did you?
Yeah, I think I'm hysterical now.
Well, Peter Millman, I want to thank you a lot. I wish you good luck.
Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun, Terry.
Peter Millman is the creator of the new ABC sitcom, It's Like, You Know, the third episode airs tonight. Here's a scene from the upcoming episode of the series that Peter Millman said he got so much pleasure from writing. In this scene, Arthur, played by Chris Eigman, and Robbie, played by Stephen Eckold, are in a car talking about sex and relationships.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, I still like a meaningful relationship with a smart, down-to-earth girl.
In Los Angeles? That's like going to London for dental work. So, what's recreational sex like, anyway?
You really want to know?
Yeah.
Actually, it's the best sex there is.
Great.
See, that kind of sex is so mindless, there's no pressure, so you perform much better.
So that means I've probably never been good in bed.
Probably not.
It's hard enough to get them into bed. You have to be good, too. Never ends.
Yeah, and as soon as there's love involved, it's hard to be good because you're trying so hard to be good.
Oh, you would not believe how hard I try. I concentrate to a degree usually reserved for splitting atoms. I'm there exploring, tabulating, running tests, checking flowcharts, taking samples, doing market research. You think I earn my orgasm on a commission basis?
That's the saddest thing I've ever heard.
That's not that sad. It's pathetic.
Coming up, the second and third generation owners of a restaurant that's a Brooklyn institution. This is Fresh Air. When I was a girl growing up in Brooklyn, my mother would occasionally take me to the department stores in downtown Brooklyn. The best part of the day was lunch at Junior's restaurant. The shrimp salad sandwiches had so many shrimp, large shrimp, you needed a fork to eat the salad that fell off the delicious rye bread. I lost track of the restaurant when I left Brooklyn, so I was delighted to find a new book called Welcome to Junior's, written with the restaurant's owners, filled with recipes and Brooklyn history. Junior's opened in 1950, replacing a sandwich shop that had been opened by the same family in 1929. My guests are Marvin and Alan Rosen, respectively second and third generation owners of Junior's. The book reprints a menu from the 50s. I asked if Junior's still serves the same dishes.
The two items that people always ask me that I can say that are not on the menu anymore that used to be on the menu are beef flonkin and chicken in the pot.
How about charcoal broiled lamb chops on toast? I don't imagine that would still be a popular dish.
It's no longer on toast. Now we have pork chops, but we don't have lamb chops.
Right.
Junior's always had a peculiar way. We always used to say a la Junior's, a peculiar way of serving certain things. That might be one of them on toast.
Okay, tell me if you still have this pie, prune and apricot pie.
No.
Right.
Prune Danish.
Prune Danish.
Yes.
By popular demand, we no longer have it on the menu.
No, what about Nestle Road whipped cream pie? I haven't heard the word Nestle Road pie in years. It's
Nestle Road pie is a like derivative of a rum-type flavor, tutti-frutti-type pie. And honestly, that went out with rock and roll, I must say. We used to sell an enormous amount of cream pies, an enormous that were all topped with whipped cream. But there's no question that whipped cream is really, you know, not gone by the wayside, but people are whipped cream conscious as opposed to cheesecake, that delete. Whipped cream, second thoughts about that, though. We do not have that. That is no longer on the menu.
Now, Marvin Rosen, your father, Harry, yes, opened a sandwich shop on the location that Junior's is at. And I think this was during the Prohibition?
Yes, in 1929.
Did he have any? So it was Prohibition and Depression.
That's right.
What were some of his favorite stories about starting a restaurant during that time?
Well, first of all, I believe he got married in 1929, is when the stock market crashed. And he got a nice telegram on his honeymoon in Niagara Falls that you broke. So that was the beginning of it.
He had the telegram told him about the stock market crash?
The stock market had crashed, right. And you are broke. You're out. And because at that time, I think it was, you had to put up 10% margin, and that was it. He got wiped out. So from a comfortable young married gentleman, he became very poor. So my mother said, wow, I married you, you were rich, and now look at you 3 days later. In any event, on the more serious side, he then, with his brother Mike at the time, got together and opened up a little small horseshoe-type sandwich counter called the Enduro Sandwich Shop. And Luncheonette, which was right across the street from the Paramount Theater at the time, they had vaudeville, Eddie Cantor, Rudy Valley. All the old-timers used to perform there and come in. And throughout the years, things got better, and he expanded and expanded and expanded until he had the entire 10,000-square-foot corner, and it was called the Enduro, which was completed by 1939 or 40. He had music, he had a band, and there was stage shows, steaks, and charcoal broiler in the window. They would show you how the steaks were cooked. There was a refrigerated showcase.
Oh, I used to love that in New York when those places that had the grill
in the window. All the grill in the window, and there was a refrigerated showcase showing all the meats, the steaks, and chops. And it was quite the operation. It was very, very big.
Now the book says that the founder of Junior's, and this would be Alan's grandfather and Marvin's father, had a gambling problem, and there was a period when the Enduro, the restaurant that preceded Junior's that the family owned, was going broke. So Marvin, your father, tried to gamble and win enough money to save the restaurant. But what happened?
No, he had made, I guess he had made a lot of money. And you know what happens when a young guy makes a lot of money. He has to find ways of getting rid of it, right? So he enjoyed watching the horses run. And he liked those things called dominoes, or crap shooting is what you call them. And he had his kicks, he had his ups and his downs. But one thing he knew how to do, and I think it rubbed off on all of us, he knew how to make money. He was a comeback kid. And I don't know if it's in the book. When he reopened Junior's, he was always known as a very, very, very good dresser. And, of course, at the time, he could not afford his expensive label suits. So what he did is he went to a local men's clothing store, bought a few suits, had the labels taken out by his tailor, had labels from Saks Fifth Avenue put in. It might sound corny, but this was my father. He was a showman because the customers always looked up to him. He was a great host. When you walked in the Junior's, you knew Harry Rosen was at that front door. When you heard the snap of a finger, that snap meant the hostess should look up and it was a party of two, a party of three, a party of four. Yes, it was offensive because every time he snapped his finger, it would startle everybody. We'd jump, but that was part of Junior's. Noisy, hustle, bustle, busy, and that was it. That is the flavor of Junior's.
Marvin, what was it like to grow up the son of the owner of Junior's? Did you spend a lot of time in the restaurant?
A lot of time. I think my brother and I spent our lives in the restaurant.
You said it was tough. What was tough?
Tough. Very tough because he was very demanding. I mean, we had to dot our I's and cross the T's, and that was it. If there was a complaint by a customer, he'd point his finger to one of the sons and say, tell them about it. If there was a compliment, he would say, thank you very much. And that's the way he was. I have no regrets. He taught us well. But those were the 50s and 60s and 70s. Today, it's a different ball game today. We don't want I don't want my nephews, nor does my brother want his sons to have to work as hard as we did, because we did lose a certain part of our life, which was, you know, social and what have you. But watching our children grow up, we don't want our nephews to do it because it's not necessary. Businesses are run a little differently today. They're computerized. We have more managers. It's just a different... And better show.
Well, Alan, you are one of the aforementioned nephews. You're in the business. Why did you stay in it?
I happen to love the business. I think it's a fantastic business to be in. I think the fact that you get people coming back from years ago and they remember it then and it's still the same, that's the nicest thing anyone could say. And I've always wanted to be in the restaurant business. I've worked for other restaurants and then came back to work in my family business. And, you know, a lot of family businesses don't thrive or survive because the third or fourth generation don't want to be in that same business and go to work at 5 in the morning and go through walking boxes and look at shrimp and steaks and make sure the cheesecakes are baked properly. And that's why most businesses don't survive. And for that same reason, because my brother and I do love the business, we're going to survive.
My guests are Marvin and Ellen Rosen, second and third generation owners of Junior's Restaurant in downtown Brooklyn. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Marvin and Ellen Rosen, second and third generation owners of the Brooklyn restaurant Junior's, which has become a Brooklyn institution. There's a new Junior's cookbook. Marvin Rosen, what do you remember your father liking the most and hating the most about being in the restaurant business?
I don't think there was anything he hated about being in the business. My father loved the business. To him, it was like a show. And he was very well liked. He was an immaculate, demanding person. He would have inspection of waitresses and waiters before they would go on duty, whether it be their fingernails, their uniforms, their shoes, and he was just a nut job when he came to really, I can say it, he really was, but you know something? It paid. And today we follow suit. And I have an expression sometimes, I'll say to my nephews, you know something, if your grandfather was alive, he wouldn't allow this. You know, he wouldn't this, he wouldn't that. Because it was so instilled in my brother's head and mine that it was one way. He was a great, tough operator, but, you know, he was tough when we were there, but at home, he was a father, and he always said that because at times we'd complain to our mother how tough Daddy was and how tough he was, and she'd go to Daddy and say, what are you so tough on him for? And he'd say, shut up, because, you know something, you run your business, I'll run mine. And sure enough, my mother would come back and says, look, he only means well, it's for your benefit, it's not for his. And you know something? I look back today, so many, many years later, it did not hurt. I have no regrets. My brother has no regrets. We don't have any regrets because we have a beautiful business, and we've had a pretty good run. You know, something for a restaurant, Junior's alone, to be nearing 50 years, I guess we must be doing something right.
What are some of the things that you do today at Junior's that you think your father would have strenuously objected to?
I think the first thing would be is that we leave a little earlier than we used to. Instead of putting in 12 and 14 hours a day, we do on occasion, but instead of doing that, and my nephews do that on many occasions, we have learned to live a life and have managers and be demanding to the managers and having a rapport and meetings, which we never used to have. And meetings go a long, long way. And what you want, you tell them, and that's it. There's no, we don't believe in reprimanding a manager or an employee in front of anybody. If we have anything to say to anybody, we say it to them on the side, as opposed to where my father, if he, in the middle of a lunch hour, would see a waitress giving poor service, he would, like, go crazy. And that would make matters worse. So the customer would never get served, and the waitress would start to cry. So my father would wind up doing the serving. So that's it. It's a different generation today.
Ellen, what are some of the things that you've done with the restaurant that are different from the other two generations that have run it?
Well, it's funny. When my brother and I came into the business, I mean, there wasn't a computer to be found. And obviously in today's day and age, you know, computers are part of the restaurant business. People see them in every computer and take them for granted. But it's, you know, that's one thing. Plus, we market ourselves. We do lots of fun things. You know, during the O.J. Simpson trial, someone had said something bad about Peter Neufeld's Brooklyn accent. He was one of the attorneys in the case. They made fun of his Brooklyn accent. And Junior's, as a representative of Brooklyn, decided that we were going to send the cheesecake to him with a note on it. and it said Brooklyn to Judge Ito, you know, bite me, which probably wasn't the most politically correct thing to do at the time. But, you know, Brooklynites were a little upset. They were making fun of how we speak. And so Junior's just gets involved in more ways now. And we're just more active in the community. And with Cheesecake, with bets on World Series and all stuff like that, Junior's always seems to be involved.
Now, the founder of Junior's, which was Marvin Rosen's father and Alan Rosen's grandfather, he used to be, well, like the maitre d' when he was at the restaurant, right? He'd greet people at the door and snap his fingers so that a waiter or a waitress could show them to the table. Mm-hmm. Did you ever do that yourselves?
Yes, we did it.
Well, why does the owner take on that role? I've often wondered that.
Only because we saw our father do it. And my brother and I operated the restaurant. We just worked it together. I mean, one would be front, one would be back. One back of the house, one front. So we really knew where one another were all the time. And you know something? It worked very, very well that way. At that time, we didn't have managers. My brother and I were managers. One would work days, one would work nights. One came in the morning, the other one came in 11, 12 o'clock. Work through dinner, sometimes later. So that was part of Junior's. Again, I say, today you walk into a restaurant, you don't even see a manager because everybody has their jobs to be done and the manager is not to be seen, which is a big change today in the restaurant business. My father, as I said, used to be a fashion plate, have beautiful fancy suits on, and that was him. He wanted to be known as the boss, and he was.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you very much.
Marvin and Alan Rosen are second and third generation owners of Junior's Restaurant in Brooklyn. Marvin Rosen is a co-author of the new book, Welcome to Junior's. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Tariq Rose.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Garden.com, an online source for gardening advice and home delivery of over 14,000 plants, tools, and gardening products, and from Little Brown & Company, publishers of All Too Human, a political education by George Stephanopoulos, in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Michael Isikoff is credited with being the first journalist to investigate the Monica Lewinsky story. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with him about working with sources he knew had ulterior motives. He's written a new book called Uncovering Clinton. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.